The 20th century was host to a number of global events that had decades-long influence on the lives of citizens from almost every nation. From world wars, huge advances in technology, social changes, and the rise and fall of political movements, most of the events of the last century were captured in moving images. I'm Charles Horak, and you're listening to On Film. One of the defining and lasting events of the last century was the almost 50-year-long geopolitical struggle between Western democracy and Eastern communism and the nuclear arms race that ensued, usually referred to as the Cold War. A new online exhibition by the Texas Archive of the Moving Image titled When Texas Saw Red pairs important turning points from the tumultuous history of this period with moving images made by Texas citizens. To discuss the new exhibition, I'm delighted to have Madeline Moya, curator and producer of the exhibit, on the program today. Good morning.
Hi, Charles.
Great to have you. I know you've been with the Texas Archive of the Moving Image for a number of years now. Why don't you start off by just describing what TAMI does and how it's different from a lot of the film archives in the country?
Okay. The Texas Archive of the Moving Image, or TAMI as we refer to it, is a nonprofit organization that works to discover, preserve, provide access to, and educate the community about Texas's film heritage. Films and videos are not made to last. So over 50% of Hollywood movies made before 1950 are now considered lost. Mm-hmm. And for Texas-produced material, statistics are estimated at closer to 90%. So TAMI works to rescue these moving images and showcase their contribution to Texas history. So our collection, unlike many film archives, kind of contains the other side of film preservation, the non-cinema Hollywood side. Mm-hmm. We do have some Hollywood-produced moving images of Texas, but the bulk of our collection are home movies, amateur films, advertisements, local television, local news, industrial films, and government films.
And you collect and archive just about anything as long as it has some sort of Texas connection.
That's right. So many of you El Pasoans may be familiar with our main project, which is called the Texas Film Roundup. It's a traveling program that goes around the state to collect film that we call Texas-related. We define that as made in Texas, about Texas, or by Texans. So we travel around the state and have people come out and bring us films and videos that are Texas-related to contribute to our archives.
The great thing is that you take those in, those originals from people's home movies to old videos, things they can no longer watch because the technology is gone or they don't know how to watch it, and you digitize that for them and give them back their originals plus a digital copy so they can enjoy it. But then all of those images go up as part of the archive and is sortable online so people can see and link to their own images and lots of other people can research those. I'm wondering, at some point going through your growing archive online, did you notice there was a lot of moving images from the period of the Cold War? And is that how this exhibition got started, or is this just an interest of yours personally?
It's kind of a combination of things. We do have a lot of really good propaganda films and campaign footage and news footage, and, of course, home movies from the era since it lasted so many decades.
Sure.
But also in this past November, the world celebrated the 25th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. And then just a few weeks later, the United States and Cuba announced that they would normalize diplomatic relations after more than 50 years. So that was one of the last chapters of the Cold War that was closing. Hmm. So with the passing of those two events, we thought it would just be a really good time to pull together those really unique materials that we have in our collection that kind of showcase how Americans and Texans reacted to and lived with the Cold War.
It is amazing to think that the Cold War, as we think of it, ended so many decades ago, yet it still, in many ways, controls politically how we view the world, how we think of struggles. And as you mentioned, Cuba is sort of one of the last chapters of that. So many decades later, we're just now beginning to talk with them. But then you have the rise of Russian ambitions, you know, their actions in Ukraine, and that's the framework people are beginning to look at again. Is this the beginning of the recreation of the USSR?
Absolutely. As I was researching, I was surprised. You know, I kept figuring out over and over again, like, oh, this is what informed this current conflict, and this current event is, you know, a result of something that happened during the, you know, basically all of our current foreign relationships were informed by the Cold War. It was just really fascinating to watch as the research unfolded.
One of the impressive things about the exhibit is how you've managed to take the milestones and the developments during this 50-year period and distill them so succinctly and powerfully into this online exhibition, which is actually organized, I found, very much like a non-virtual exhibition in that you've broken into five major categories and you lead the viewer through almost like digital hallways of organized materials. That must have been hard to get to, but you begin with the Berlin airlift in 1948 and conclude somewhere in the early 90s with the dissolution of the Soviet Union and the normalization of some relations between mm-hmm. the different countries. But I want to go back to the very beginning. One of the iconic government-produced films, Duck and Cover, from 1951, which I think if people know anything of the Cold War, that's the one that lingers because it's about this propaganda that somehow we could hide behind walls and buses and under our desks to survive a nuclear
attack. You know, I think every American saw that film. And even, you know, decades later, kids were still being taught to duck and cover in the case of an attack. And they make a really accessible turtle be the host of the film. It's a cartoon and it's real friendly. And, you know, it's like just duck and cover and, you know, this huge explosion that's going to come knock down the walls, you'll be safe.
It's laughable now, but it's really a great window you start with into the times and the power of moving images in the 20th century to sort of have authority over our lives, that we actually believed what we were seeing. You quickly go to some home movies, though, of a Houston evacuation exercise. I thought was fascinating because it brings it back to Texas and to our mm-hmm. own cities, and this air raid is going off, and I'm not sure which collection it came from, but it appears to be a home movie of a exercise.
I believe it was some news footage that was unedited, and mm-hmm. I don't know if it ended up being used for broadcast or not, but it shows downtown Houston, Main Street, cops on horses, and you know the siren is going off, and everyone's practicing their evacuation drill. So you see just cars and citizens pouring onto Main Street and following the evacuation path. And these things, you know, were taught to everyone. Everyone knew where they needed to go in the case of nuclear attack. Just like all the students knew that they needed to duck and cover, it just became a part of everyday life.
It seems extremely orderly, too, and that's one of the themes I see running through a lot of the government-produced films in your archive, is that the films are not only meant to scare, that this threat is imminent, but also to assure us that we're ready, that we can survive this, that if you just do X, Y, or Z, mm-hmm. you're going to be okay.
Well, that actually is really well illustrated in Target Austin, which was produced by Austin's KTBC. It follows three different characters from the Conelrad announcement through the evacuation. And it starts with a family that has a bomb shelter and a family plan in place. And when the Conelrad announcement goes out, they go into their bomb shelter and they emerge from the nuclear event completely unscathed, even having a nice family dinner and story time before bed down in their shelter. And then there's a woman who doesn't take the nuclear alarm seriously. She thinks it's just another drill and ignores the alarm to do her makeup. But she ends up doing okay because her office building has an emergency procedure in place.
Oh, thank goodness.
But last, she just stops and powders her face. But lastly, there's a man that completely disregards all government procedures and decides to make a go of it on his own and evacuate the city. Mm-hmm. So he does not fare well, and he comes to a rather horrific end. So it reinforces the do what the government tells you, have your plan in place, get down into your shelter, and you'll be safe.
I was happy to see that the exhibit also turns its gaze back on ourselves, because during the Cold War, there was quite a bit of hysteria in this country through the Red Scare and McCarthyism. And you do have some footage discussing the blacklist, particularly one that I found really powerful was Cactus Pryor, an Austinite, discussing blacklist victim John Henry Falk and his fairly groundbreaking libel case that he won. Mm-hmm. But it really gives you a regular person's perspective of some of the effects of the Cold War on individuals in this country.
Yeah, John Henry Falk's story it's kind of a tragedy. He was a Texas writer and a humorist and a television personality. Many people probably know his name. but his entertainment career effectively ended due to that blacklisting. In 1957, he had spoken out against Aware Incorporated that was creating the blacklist, and in 1957, likely in retaliation, that Aware blacklisted John Henry Falk for communist associations and sympathies. Falk filed and won a libel suit against the organization, as you mentioned, and he won a settlement that the jury determined was fair compensation, but was actually a much larger sum than Falk had originally sought. But that's what the jury felt was fair. They felt he had been so wronged that they gave him a much larger compensation. Despite the win, his entertainment career was done.
Yeah, bittersweet.
So he had to leave New York and come back to Austin, and really the only gig he could get after that was on Hee Haw, which I'm sure he was grateful for, but, you know, he had his own nationally broadcast CBS radio program before that. And Cactus Pryor talks in this interview about when he was trying to get his friend work, because Cactus Pryor worked for KTBC, that his family and Cactus Pryor himself were bullied, and people wrote letters and questioned their patriotism as well for associating with John Henry Falk.
One of the things the exhibit does is show that the Cold War wasn't just about the Soviet Union and the U.S. It spiraled into a number of new fronts. Let's just say it popped up in a number of proxy wars and or proxy fights around the globe. One of those was the Iranian hostage crisis and also the exile of the Shah there, which was supported by the U.S. And you have this wonderful footage of I guess it was a family from Plano, Texas, the Yousefi family, who happened to be in Tehran on the day the Shah went into exile and shot a lot of home movies.
We could check with the family, but I'm under the impression that they were living in Iran and left when all of this was happening and came and immigrated here to Plano. So these home movies are just very powerful. They're just out on the street driving with their family, but you see people just out in the street rejoicing. They are congregating and happy and holding signs. It's just a very joyous occasion for the people in Tehran. And then later in the whole movie, they, you know, are out in mass with signs of Khomeini, the Islam leader that eventually replaced the Shah and instated the first militant Islam government.
Yeah, well, this really speaks to those sort of these witnesses to history that had cameras, which was really a new development in the 20th century that we no longer, now looking back, we don't have to just rely on official newsreels and government propaganda to analyze history. We have all of these new moving images to sort through, thanks to Tammy. And I'm wondering just how does it change how we view the past to have images like these alongside the more traditionally authoritative films and newsreels?
It's definitely one of the most important aspects of our work, because home movies are such excellent documents of history from the citizen's perspective. As you said, you know, most of our official records as a people are made by the government and by organizations with authority. They're the ones that create our records. Our, you know, archives were created to house government records, and that kind of dictates history. So home movies are told by the citizen, and it captures an everyday experience of what people are doing with their families and how they celebrate and how they live their daily lives. So in the context of the Cold War, they offer a really good glimpse into how people were living with Cold War culture and reacting to all of the implications of the conflict.
We've met before, and I gather you were probably born around the time the Cold War was winding down. So it was something in your past as you grew up and maybe studied in school. I wonder, as you put this exhibit together, how your understanding of this period might have changed.
I mean, I'll be honest, my mind was blown. I was in sixth grade when the Berlin Wall fell, and I remember it happening. And I remember it being a big deal to all of the adults, but, you know, we really didn't understand as children exactly what a monumental occasion it was. So as I was working on this, I realized just how pervasive the conflict was in our lives, even mine growing up, you know, things I didn't realize, and how little of it was taught to me growing up in school, just because we didn't have enough distance from it yet. And it, like I said before, it really illuminated so many current foreign relations in our current conflicts.
I want to mention, too, that Texas Archive of the Moving Image and this exhibition have a number of teaching tools available online for teachers. So listeners who know teachers or are teachers of history, there's a lot of great resources there to use these images.
I just wanted to mention that we also did just release a lesson plan that accompanies the exhibit. They're all TEKS compliant, and they're free for use in the classroom. There's a lesson plan for grades 3 through 5, 6 through 8, and 9 through 12. And they all rely on the films and the exhibit as primary source materials. So they're really great for Texas teachers of social studies.
Great. I've been discussing the Texas Archive of the Moving Image's new online exhibition, When Texas Saw Red, with the exhibit's curator and producer, Madeline Moya. When Texas Saw Red chronicles the almost 50-year history of the Cold War through print and moving image selections and contextualizes the Cold War and its impacts on Texans through the use of some of the archive's preserved home movies, newsreels, and commercial moving images. To experience the exhibition When Texas Saw Red and to learn more about the Texas Archive of the Moving Image and its collections, log on to texasarchive.org. On Film's producer is Norma Martinez. An archive of past programs is available on this station's website at ktep.org. I'm Charles Horak. Thank you for listening to On Film.